All right, ladies and gentlemen. Oh boy, I got a double echo in my head. Gonna have to take my headset off. Okay, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. And just as a symptom of the fact that the entirety of our world is different, there's nobody in here and the computers aren't set up. There's no bumper music set in. There's no commercials to play. So we'll see how this goes. I have a call on the line, but I have to figure out how to hear it because there's nobody in here. Welcome to 2020. This is Jake McClure. If you'd like to email in here, the emails are jeff at tpwc.com and jake at tpwc.com. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. I'm going to try to bring up the microphone for Elder Baldy, and maybe he can take this as I try to figure out what's going on with the board and the computers, because there's nobody in here to help. I'm going to try it now. I won't be able to hear you, but you will be able to hear me, hopefully. So, Elder Baldy, if you're on the air, go ahead and start speaking.
All right, I'm here. And so you apparently can't hear me, although I can hear you, which is the typical way that conversations ensue. I don't know. I presume you haven't done the disclosures and disclaimers yet. First, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, which you probably figured out if you're listening to the radio program. Secondly, the name of the Personal Wealth Coach is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, who the commission wants us to tell you that they neither approve or disapprove of anything we say or do. Actually, they disapprove of everything.
That's their job. They're regulators. And I can hear you now. I can hear me now. And it's only coming across the line as one voice when I talk. So,
cool. Well, you didn't want multiple voices, did you?
But we can continue with the disclosures in a moment, but we will not likely be playing any commercials today or bumper music. I'm not really going to know what's going on. So
you're on the deck of a ship that is descending beneath the waves.
I am definitely on the deck. It is on autopilot, and my attempts to move the wheel have resulted in nothing.
But at least it's a collective nothing.
Yes. Collectively, the aggregate is still nothing, so the average is also at nothing.
Let's see. I said that the Personal Wealth Coach is also an SEC registered investment advisor and said that the SEC neither approves nor disapproves of anything we do and will disavow all knowledge.
Yes.
Well, they won't disavow all knowledge. They'll just hammer us if we do something wrong.
Yes.
And they find out about it.
Yeah.
The reason we say SEC registered, as long as we're talking about such things, the Securities Exchange Commission regulates investment advisors with over $100 million under management. Below $100 million, the states regulate them. And since we have over $100 million under management, the SEC regulates us, and that's all it means. We are, of course, considered to be a large, although that is ridiculous, investment advisory firm. We can consider that many, many investment advisory firms manage billions of dollars.
Multiples of billions. Many billions, yes.
Yeah, billions and billions of dollars. I don't know if any of them manage a trillion yet, but they're up there. Anyway, let's see, what else do we have to say? We have to say that we advertise on KTEM, but we don't pay for the show. And we advertise on KTEM for the radio show that we don't pay for and they don't pay us for. Of course, they're apparently not paying anybody else to do anything either, but I actually had a call into them this week. I left a couple of messages in there and didn't receive a call back, so I don't think there's anybody in there during the week either. So it's running. You're literally on board an institution that's running on autopilot.
Well,
so we're seeing how well. What? Go ahead.
Exactly. So consider the fact that the background for this entire thing is running on a computer, and I'm looking at the computer, and the software that runs it is not running.
Hmm.
But it's still doing stuff. So, it's just taking the human out of the loop. It is, Hal is in control at the moment.
And nobody's monitoring Hal, and Hal is getting a little bit senile.
Yeah, I was just telling him to do something, and he was saying, I can't do that, Jake. Jake, please step away from that red button. Jake.
Well, Jake. We managed to get on the we've managed to get on the air again anyway. Let's see what else we got.
When purely mechanical means, I've only been here long enough to know how to hit the right switches so that mechanically we can get on instead of through the digital software environment. So hopefully I haven't broken any regulations in the process. We'll see.
It all depends on what was on the air before we came on. If they did a station ID at the top of the hour, which they
Well, the station ID happened, which is
good.
Part of the confusion, because that stuff's usually on the computer, and the computer tells it to run, and it's not on the computer. So somehow it's just memorized its lines well enough that the radio is just running itself.
You know, we've been talking about eventually going to straight podcast and not doing the radio, and we've been talking about that because of the potential for the radio station not to be there, and that may be coming sooner than we would desire.
Yeah.
And that's something that fits in with the nature of the show that we're doing, the
Absolutely.
Program that we're doing. The economy is in crisis, and there's a lot of the crisis we haven't seen yet. Let's see, what else do we need? Oh, yeah, the information that we present on this program is not investment advice, even though the we are principals of a registered investment advisory firm.
Right. This is educational in nature. If we were going to give you investment advice, we'd have to do it individually, and we would have to know your goals, your circumstances, the tolerances that you have for risk. That's a custom thing. And it's really hard to do custom one-size-fits-all. It's almost an oxymoron.
Well, I know a lot of businesses try to do that. We've already gotten two questions in, by the way. Let's see what other disclosures we need. Oh, the information we present on this program is from information. Oh, this is, from sources we deem, this is my one opportunity to use
yes.
it, reliable and consistent. And, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information. I love that. I get to use deem once a week, see?
Yeah. So I got a question, too. Is it one of yours from John?
Yeah, you got one from John, and I got one from Roger.
Okay. So let's hit John first, lightly, with gloves on.
Latex gloves.
Yes. He says, many, many companies are going out of business due to COVID. Does this include investment companies and advisors? Have not read anything about this category. It does include, just at a much smaller pace, a much lower pace.
Well, there's been several hedge funds that have returned the money that was left to their investors and said, we're not going to do that anymore. Some
right.
big ones.
Yeah. So,
I guess there's, in a sense, they're going out of business. Actually, what they've said is we're just going to manage the billions of dollars that we made managing money for other people, but we're not going to manage money anymore because you're pulling your money out because we've done so poorly.
Yeah. So what we're seeing is that just like in any other business, falls back directly onto their investment philosophy before COVID hit. If they were doing something that was ultra aggressive and ultra risky, it became more so when COVID hit. And that's what we're seeing across the board with retail as well. I mean, you can just compare the same thing. If you were on the edge of collapse already and maybe even didn't know it, then it's much more likely that COVID knocked you down. In the case of JCPenney, they knew it. In the case of some of the hedge funds, they didn't know it. They were thinking that their philosophy on aggressive investing and leveraging themselves and investing as much as you can and all the borrowed money that you can into as highly aggressive as you can, there's risk associated. And they were convincing themselves that the risks weren't real or that they were somehow smarter than the risks. And that's the story in this entire range of business in the money management. On the advisor side, Wells Fargo is talking about laying off a bunch of people because if you have an advisory firm, and that's the one that gives advice, let's separate that out for a second from commission-based sales organizations, broker-dealers, those that call themselves advisors still, they'll call themselves a financial advisor rather than an investment advisor. But if they get the majority of their income from commissions, and if their broker-dealer, Wells Fargo in this particular case, is getting a large percentage of its revenue from commissions, there have been a lot fewer commissions during this period. People are less likely to come in with absolutely new money into the market. And that's how a lot of the commission-based financial advisors have run their business, that they sink if they don't have new money coming in. Well, the new money is pretty well dried up. If people get money, it's usually at this point, there's some people that are investing it, but a large percentage of people are leaving it in the bank for safety, which is definitely going to be putting a strain on a lot of the big broker-dealers out there. They're already experiencing it, but if this keeps going on, and it has every sign of doing that, it's not magically going away.
Well, I was looking, actually, for investment advisors going out of business earlier this week, just to see how they were doing in general, and apparently they're thriving, and they're thriving.
Most investment advisors, the fiduciaries, are doing quite well.
Basically, as a matter of fact, they're growing. A lot of people are leaving the alternative investments and, well, not alternative investments. They're leaving things like their, quote, financial advisor at Wells Fargo, as you were talking about, or something, someplace where they're paying commissions and moving over to a fiduciary investment advisor. As people become more educated, they realize, and I think that will probably accelerate with the advent of the new regulations from the SEC, they realize that people who are being paid by the company that they're recommending to be in, that you invest in, have an inherent conflict of interest. And it's not that they're evil. It's just very simple. If you go to, well, I used to say this about Sears, and most of our listeners will remember Sears, but if you went to Sears, and you said, I need a wrench, or I need a washing machine, or I need whatever I need, the person at Sears gets paid by Sears to sell that to you. They're not going to say, hey, you know, you realize you could go to Best Buy or Walmart and get it cheaper.
That's not true if they're a Santa Claus on 42nd Street, though.
That's true, but that was a long time ago.
There was a miracle. It only happened once, so...
Yeah, but the point is, if you go into a given store and the salesperson that you're speaking to, the product advisor, yeah, that's what they are, that you're speaking to, tells you to buy something there, they have a conflict of interest, and you understand that conflict of interest. But when somebody calls themselves a financial advisor and they say, here's what I advise you to get, there is an assumption that they're acting in your best interest when in many cases they're acting in their best interest. And that's understood in a sales situation. But as soon as they start saying advisor, it kind of slips over into a different area. If you're working with a legitimate independent investment advisory firm, meaning one that is not in the business with a broker dealer in the business of selling stuff and receiving payments from the companies that you're buying, you're probably going to get better advice, simply because you've eliminated a major conflict of interest. Now, on the other hand, if you happen to have somebody who is in this investment advisory firm who has no credentials and who has no expertise and no knowledge, they just think they're smart, I'm not sure. At least they're going to give you honestly bad advice as opposed to dishonestly bad advice. But
right,
it does eliminate one major thing. And as a result, investment advisory firms seem to be doing very, very well. Of course, it helps that the market has done very, very well, relatively speaking, compared with the rest of the economy.
Yeah.
And
that could go the other direction.
Short question.
Yeah, if the market has a second big tank, and we say that if, we're in unexplored territory, folks. This is the first time in the history of the world that we've had a pandemic hit that we were all aware of at the time. I know that sounds weird, because there were headlines for the Spanish flu and the Hong Kong flu, and you can go back through all the different eras, and people knew about Black Death. Yeah, but they didn't know about it the way we know about this. There are people tracking statistics like they are tapped into the Matrix on this pandemic. That's never happened before. So the knowledge of where we are, the trend lines on where we are, is held by the public at this point. If we continue to make, misjudged decisions on how we should act when there's a pandemic going along, that's likely at some point to affect the market. It's been extremely stable, and I expect my thought, and this, you can tell me what your opinion is on this, and if you would like, but my thought is that I'm going to overlay what's happened in the past 2 months in the market, maybe even just the month and a half in the market that isn't directly pandemic related. It's just we've been stable within a very narrow range. It's still wider than the normal range, but pretty stable in the market. We haven't grown tremendously or shrunk tremendously in this time period. And that looks amazingly like every other presidential election season I've ever seen. And when we overlay the graphs on presidential election seasons, we see pretty clearly that the market goes into holding pattern until we figure out who the next president's going to be. And if we have a growth in earnings during this time period, we'll see an explosion in the market upward. If we have less earnings, if earnings are down, we'll see the market drop after the election. And that doesn't really matter who wins. So that's just market reaction historically. And I have a tendency to think that, especially now, because there is so much hinged on policy and I mean, that there's no other way around this. The number one factor in the economy right now is not the president, it's not taxes, it's not unemployment, it's not any of the statistics that we're using to measure. It's the pandemic. Because all those other statistics are contingent on this. We got to stop the spread. And that's...
We got another...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah,
we have another
ahead.
Question, by the way.
What is it? Is this one from Roger?
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
Since I'm usually walking on my treadmill while listening to the program, so I'm sending this in advance. A few weeks ago, you mentioned this destabilization of Europe/Russia, which would likely ensue because of pulling troops from Germany. Will we achieve the same effect if the same number of troops, resources are shifted to Poland? Also, Trump has weakened our commitment to NATO. Is renewing this commitment needed along with the troops, or is either measure alone sufficient? What do you deem to be the answer? I know how much you like the word.
Ha ha.
And he says, love the program, and thanks to you and Jake for doing it.
Oh, that was nice.
For starters, let me eliminate one of the ifs in your question. The troops that are being pulled out of Germany are being pulled out of NATO in Europe in general. There's a ceiling established for the number of troops we can have at any given moment in Germany, established by the United States. I think it was about 52,000. We had about 26,000 there, and we're pulling 9,000. About half of those troops are being 9,500 are being pulled out of Germany.
So we're just over 15 is the number we'll be at in Germany.
And the ceiling...
15,000, sorry, not just 15.
Now, the ceiling on the maximum number of troops that will be allowed to be in Germany by the presidential executive order also cut the ceiling in half for the maximum number of troops we can put into Germany. And what that means is we can't do the build-up exercise that we do intermittently with the NATO troops anymore. We just can't do it anymore because we can't put the troops over there to do it, which means we can no longer train effectively with the NATO troops in Europe. If for example, there becomes a threat against Poland or against the Baltic states, as long as this – well, actually, the whole system, the whole military system, the logistics system and everything that involves in getting troops over there is now limited – to sending at most 25,000 troops, which is not a lot in modern parlance. That is not enough to really counter what Russia might do at any given point. It destabilizes things tremendously. It is a strong signal that if Russia takes action, we're not going to do much against it. I mean, it really clearly says we're not going to put more than 25,000 troops in NATO at any given moment, or in Germany at any given moment.
Yeah.
And they're... The other thing about moving them to Poland, and I read a lot about moving, what if we just shift the assets to Poland?
No, there's a presidential election going on in Poland now between, it's a pretty tight election between someone that really likes NATO and someone that really doesn't like NATO. So this is going to hinge on that as well.
There's another problem. You can't just move them to NATO and put them in pup tents. I mean, you can't move them to Poland and put them in pup tents. They got to. We have facilities in Germany that we captured from the Wehrmacht, and that's where the troops live. That's where they keep their tanks. That's where they keep their helicopters. And when we abandon those positions, when we leave them, our agreement with NATO says we turn them back over to the Germans, and we can't just take them back again if we decide to take them back again. In other words, keeping troops permanently stationed in Germany has been credited by literally every scholar and every general and every strategic thinker I know of with preventing a world war on two occasions since World War II.
Yeah.
The mere fact that our troops are there, just the mere fact that we have a lot of troops in Germany has prevented Europe from going into its once-a-generation major war that it's experienced before. It's also been a major deterrent to Russia moving in and taking a piece of a NATO country. If we have enough capacity in Germany to move quickly to counter some move that Russia makes, then Russia is going to be very hesitant to make the move. And when we talk about reducing the number of troops in Germany, you got to understand the troops that are being pulled out of Germany are almost totally combat troops. And there's a ratio where there's multiple support troops for every combat troop. But we have big hospitals in Germany, Landstuhl and other places in Germany. When people come back from the Middle East or Southwest Asia, more appropriately, injured because of the wars we're fighting there, they're flown into the military hospitals in Germany where they recover, and then they're flown on to the United States. And that is a big thing. We have, in other words, we have a lot of support infrastructure in Germany that supports the U.S. troops in Italy and all over around the rest of the world. We're leaving that support infrastructure in place to support someplace else, but we're pulling our combat troops out. It's almost exclusively combat troops we're pulling out, which when you consider that only about half the troops are a little less that are in Germany are combat troops, and we're pulling about half the troops out of Germany, it's going to leave the combat strength that we have in NATO probably cut by two-thirds or three-quarters. And I don't know that there's any good, no general, no person of who has intellectual weight in the area of strategic thinking vis-a-vis the ongoing tension, strategic tension between the United States and Russia, thinks this is a good idea. They are universally think it's going to destabilize things. For instance, if Russia decided, and their pattern has been very simple, some place where a lot of people speak Russian and carry Russian passports, they consider to be properly part of Russia. Estonia is one of those places, which is a NATO country. If we don't have sufficient combat forces to oppose Russia's taking a chunk of Estonia, we've seen that Russia will do it. And they do it, and then like we did with Crimea, but the troops that move in there aren't wearing Russian patches. They aren't flying the Russian flag. They're just wearing green and just happen to speak Russian and be former members of the military, of the Russian military, who temporarily are on leave or something. In other words, if a few divisions of Russian troops decide to move into Estonia while they're on leave, if we have sufficient forces that we can move immediately to oppose that and force them out, Russia probably won't do it. If we don't have the forces there to do that, as soon as Russia does a calculation and says we're not going to do anything, then Russia will do it, because they believe quite sincerely, Putin believes quite sincerely, that any place that once was part of the Soviet Union properly belongs to be part of Russia today. And any sign of weakness, he's going to do it. Why hasn't he done it so far? I don't know. And I think that's the whole idea in maintaining a credible counterforce. In other words, despite what some people on the left are saying, shutting down the police force won't make things better.
Nope.
The reason a lot of criminals don't act criminally, they don't rob houses and shoot people and burglarize places, is simply because they know the police will show up in a few minutes. If you remove the police, or you cut the police force in half where they can no longer afford to be active at night, for example, don't be too surprised if the criminals begin to take things they believe should be theirs. And I think that's the same thing that's true anywhere in the world. So there's your answer.
Yeah, and the election going on in Poland, one of the incumbent is a massive supporter of the Trump presidency. And I want to make that clear. He's not saying he's a supporter of the United States. He hasn't said that. He says he likes the United States and he supports President Trump. The other candidate is much more Russian-leaning. And this is in a strange world that we live in. That is the underlying. There's a lot of uncertainty here. As we pull troops out of Europe, as we approach how to treat the pandemic, as India and Africa's infection rate and death toll goes up, there's a power vacuum being left by our withdrawal from the world. Some of that withdrawal is intentional, like getting out of NATO and getting less involved with the UN, getting out of the World Health Organization. And some of it is unintentional. We have stopped sending a massive quantity of medical supplies to Africa because we need it here. And that's leaving huge authority vacuums across whole continents. It's leaving authority vacuums across major parts of the world. We could see the majority of Africa, it's already a near majority of Africa, in civil war and anarchy. We could see that the entire continent in that state just if we continue to do what we're doing right now. And the people that would step in to solve that would likely be China.
We need to give our email addresses.
Yeah, yeah. Email addresses in here because the phone lines are all filled up. Email addresses are jeff@tpwc.com, as in thepersonalwealthcoach.com, and jake@tpwc.com. So if you'd like to join the conversation, we are actually reading those emails and would love the input. We're not going to know when it's time for break or commercials or any of that good stuff, so we'll see how it goes.
So let's talk about the stock market and
let's
the
do
other
it.
Markets. The S&P 500 stock index closed out the week at 3185.04, up 1.76% for the five trailing days. Now, that's near the top of the trading range. Jake talked earlier about a trading range. Basically, 3,000 to 3,200 is the trading range of the S&P 500 since the end of May. And so all the way through June and now into July, the S&P 500 has wandered up near 3,200, and then it sinks back down near 3,000, and then runs back up to about 3,200. And it looks like, I mean, a 1.76% move for the week, if you project that out for the year, that's an astronomical rise in the market, except for the fact I suspect it's going to slip down a little bit. The S&P 500 is now down 1.42% for the year to date, which sounds really good. Down about 6% from its top in February, and it's up 42.35% from its bottom in March. But there's something about the S&P 500 we've mentioned a couple of times now in the newsletters that I think is very important to understand. The one-year return of the S&P 500 growth index is about 18%. The one-year return of the S&P 500 value index is down about 10%. Now, what does that mean? Growth stocks are stocks that are priced on what people expect the earnings to be a year or 2 years from now. Value stocks are priced based on the underlying value of what the company owns and what it does and its current earnings. And the spread between the two is the largest it's been since the late 1990s in the dot-com bubble. And that's something to be concerned about. I'm not saying the market's going to crash, but anytime historically that the S&P 500 growth index has gotten this carried away, and it is really carried away right now. The price-earnings ratio of the growth side of the market, the growth side, is just pretty amazingly unsustainable at this point. Now, the possibility exists, and it's certainly there, that we get a vaccine, and a year or so from now, we come back like gangbusters, and all this money that people have been saving, it suddenly goes into the stock market, it goes into buying things that are made by the companies that are in the growth index.
Yeah.
But if any stumble occurs along the way, and I think a stumble may occur, the likelihood of a stumble occurring on the growth side of the market is pretty high right now, because the expectations are absolutely astronomical, then we're going to see the growth side of the market take a real beating. You know, if we follow the pattern that we saw in 2000 through 2002 in this beating, the value stocks will probably do pretty well. And they'll just basically continue to do what they've been doing, which is grow at a reduced rate over the long term and a realistic rate. And the growth and the value side will probably hold up, and the growth stocks, this is historically what's happened every time the growth stocks have taken off like this. So despite the fact that I'm really happy to see the S&P 500 up to where it's almost to the level it was at the beginning of the year, I'm really pretty concerned about that at this point.
Yeah, it really doesn't have any business being up to where it was at the beginning of the year, because at the beginning of the year we knew we had a pretty good projection of what earnings were and what they could be. Then we have this black swan event. The black swan event steps in, and everybody is worried. We shut down the economy. Nobody knows what the earnings are. We do know that they are not what they were. The majority of earnings are down from what they were. That's not earth-shattering news there. Everybody knows this. And we're approaching the same levels in the stock market that we were. It's not unusual for that to happen.
It just doesn't end well.
Right. It just generally says that unless we get what is expected, a quick return, a quick boost, then we likely see a second dip.
And there's a certain amount of I think there's more than that. There's a pretty good number of people who have invested in the stock market, in the S&P 500, not because they see earnings going to rise in the future, but because the market went up following the – I mean, it's up 42% from the bottom. And a lot of people joined in that resurgence, and they're congratulating themselves, and they're continuing to invest in there because they invest in the market because it's up, which is not, generally speaking, a particularly good way to invest in the market. Now, the Treasury, U.S. 10-year U.S. Treasury note, which is a pretty good forecaster of what the future is going to hold, it didn't join in the party. For the week, it declined. The yield declined 1.27%. It's down at 0.644%. It's down. The yield on the U.S. Treasury note, which is a good forecaster of the demand for credit, and demand for credit indicates the level of business activity, it's down 70% for 1 year. In other words, the Treasury yield market, the bond market, is saying a year from now, because we're getting a positive yield curve, a year from now things will be better, but they won't be going like gangbusters. The stock market, on the other hand, is anticipating a huge boom in the economy a year from now. And it's always a debate to see which one is going to be correct. You know, you never can tell. West Texas Intermediate Crude, which is WTI, the price of oil that we use here in the United States.
It's the Texas price.
It's the benchmark for the United States. The global benchmark is Brent crude.
That's the point. As I said, it was the Texas. We don't have to be redundant and say the national benchmark. It's Texas, right?
Texas national benchmark.
Right.
Yeah.
There you go.
But it's at 40.61. Now, that is a comfortable level. That's really a comfortable place for it to be. But you got to remember, it's still down about 50% or better from where it was at the beginning of the year, which basically says the oil futures market is in essence saying that the economy is running at about half speed. The the Treasury market is saying the economy is running at about 30% speed and probably will be for the next several years or a little better, but not doing tremendously well. The stock market is saying that a year from now, everything will be back to normal and we'll all be very happy. And frankly, the prediction accuracy of the stock market, the growth side of the stock market particularly, has proven to be very, very bad. So one of the things I think it's important to do is have your cash reserve built up. Be aware of the fact that particularly if some of the other things we're going to talk about on this radio program and some of the other things that have come out this week are accurate, we may not only have we not seen the worst in the COVID virus pandemic, we haven't even seen the tip of the iceberg yet.
Yeah, and we say this regularly because there is hope ahead after we've got the vaccine, after we move forward on this. There's a really, we both see this. There's no way we cannot see it. There's a boom out there. But we're going to be going through some pretty rough times between now and then. It's going to likely get worse before better. And by likely, I mean, I don't know any way where it can't get worse before it gets better. And this is of a much more personal nature. This is something we have said and that many experts have agreed with for a long time, that people don't tend to get serious about this sort of thing until they know somebody that's sick or they know somebody that's dying or dead. And we've mentioned this in the past that we know those people and we're experiencing that as an ongoing basis. When we have clients spread across the country, this is one of the things that I think it's important to bring up. About 3 weeks ago, we got some good feedback on a newsletter that it sounded like we were scared of COVID-19, that it sounded like we couldn't just look around and see that it wasn't that big a threat anymore, that we were opening back up. And the reason why we feel that way, why that was coming across, is because it was true. It is the one thing that can delay the boom. It is the one thing that if we don't handle it correctly, causes our economy to not just continue to live in pain, but to be hurt more and possibly permanently. So approaching this from an economics perspective, every other statistic that we quote is nearly irrelevant if we don't get a vaccine, if we don't lower the infection rate while we're waiting, if Congress doesn't pass more stimulus, if the Federal Reserve doesn't continue to support the banking system. Now, the Federal Reserve is doing its job properly. Congress is doing its job in a very congressional way, in that I was fairly sure that we would have a second stimulus by the end of June. Now they're saying maybe by the end of July. The reality is that the PPP, the Paycheck Protection Payroll program that everybody has heard about, it's got $130 billion sitting in reserves right now that hasn't been tapped by small business. And I have heard this from multiple sources, usually pretty smart people, saying if businesses are in so much trouble, why is there still money sitting in the PPP? And the answer is that you can't double dip. You have a period of time that you get it, and then you can't get it after that. And if you didn't get it the first time around because either you thought you had enough reserves on hand or you looked at the regulations that were changing day by day, hour by hour, on what got forgiven and what you owed back and the shaming that's being done to people that took the loan. Oh, you made lots of money last year. Why do you have this loan? It's causing people to be reluctant to stick their head in that particular, depending on where you're from, guillotine of putting yourself out for public ridicule by accepting money that's intended to keep people on the payroll. So we're coming to the end of the period where the paycheck protection covered we may be about to see another large spike in unemployment.
I think we are.
Because a lot of the drop in unemployment was because businesses got Paycheck Protection Program loan/grants. And the only way you can get that as a grant and not a loan is if you bring back the people that you laid off to work. And if we run out of that and people still aren't buying the way they used to, and this is, shouldn't be shocking, but I'll say it anyway, they're not buying the way they used to. Just look at car sales or refrigerator sales, or there's a lot of areas that were mainstays to the economy that are not. And other areas that are kind of taking their places, like lumber sales are way up through the roof. Home improvement projects are doing great. But that doesn't protect the people that lost their jobs in the restaurant industry that got hired back only to get shut down again.
And there's a bigger chunk of that, too. United, which didn't get a PPP program because they're too big, did get a loan, basically a grant from the federal government to keep from laying off its employees. But United Airlines just announced they're going to lay it there, warn to their employees that in August, unless there's a renewal and there's another grant to the airlines, they're going to lay off about half their employees. Boeing is laying people off. Harley-Davidson is laying people off. And they haven't done it yet. They're announcing it. What happens is a lot of corporations and small businesses got these grants or very inexpensive loans to retain employees. And they have. But the first stimulus and the second stimulus bill all assumed that this would be over in about 90 days. The problem with that assumption is that it looks like it's going to be more like 18 months before we, from the beginning of this crisis until the point where we have enough vaccine and the vaccine has been distributed sufficiently that the economy can begin to function again. And we're not there yet. We don't even have an official vaccine yet, even though some people have gone. Even though a couple of, Jake, you mentioned to me on the phone that when we were talking earlier, that a couple of companies have gone into mass production already. The problem is until the FDA approves it, until we see a vaccine administered to tens of thousands of people, and A, it works, and B, it doesn't have major side effects, we don't have a vaccine. And
you just said that until we have a vaccine, we don't have a vaccine. So
right,
that was correct. I agree with that.
I mean, there may be a vaccine, but the fact until it's widely accepted as effective and the FDA has approved it and we start and we get the nation's backing behind it, which I don't know we're going to get under this administration. And I'm not trying to be political here. I'm simply saying the president, according to his COVID task force, has not been briefed in 2 months on the status of the COVID virus. And I don't know that he's going to get behind anything to oppose the COVID virus if he's saying it's not significant and we should just open up again. And whether he's right or wrong, unless we get national backing, unified national backing behind a vaccine, chances of that vaccine being effective drop off pretty dramatically.
Yeah, maybe
until we get
a quarter to a third of people would refuse it without a national push. This is not how we conquered smallpox. Smallpox, everybody got your shot, and smallpox is gone. We're not going to have that result coming out of this. We don't have the national unity that is required to get that sort of thing done.
I got a question from John. You probably got it too. Compare the fears from today versus the Great Recession from an economic standpoint.
Ooh.
I'd like to address that if I could.
Yeah, I'd like to touch it after you're done.
The Great Recession was a sudden crash of the economic system that produced a widespread panic and fear that stuck around for quite a while and then gradually went away. As it looked like the Federal Reserve and the Congress were acting rationally to stop it from becoming something that would eat us alive and cause the Great Depression. This one is the reverse of that. There was an assumption when it started, oh, this is just another scare out of China or someplace, and it'll soon go away. And then we gradually came to the position, and this is the president led us in this, right or wrong. He gets responsibility and he gets the credit either way. He led us in saying this will soon be gone. There's just a few cases. It will soon go away. He continues to push to say we need to open up. It's not a big thing. He recently said we just would just slow the testing down, and the testing has slowed down in its results at least. Then we wouldn't have so many cases. So we are still, as a nation, not thoroughly afraid of the coronavirus. And I think it's important that...
I think we were afraid, and this is part of the behavioral nonsense going on, is that we got really scared and went to total lockdown and lived in fear for a long time and then didn't see a whole lot of death because it was all concentrated way far away from here, wherever you are. Unless you lived in New York or New Jersey, it was way far away. Why did we all shut down? And then we opened back up. And most of us still haven't seen or known or met somebody with the virus. And until that gets to be the case, it's hard for that fear to come back. It was like crying wolf, only it wasn't crying wolf in the normal sense. There were real wolves. They were just a long ways away.
Well, that's certainly true. The problem is, with this particular fear, is I think if the projections that we get from Moody's Economics, which is the one that most accurately predicted the last crisis and how it worked itself out, we're going to get the fear back, and we're going to get it back a little later in the year. It's coming right now. When this at the accelerating rate the virus is spreading right now, based on current behaviors, Moody's is suggesting that about 55% of Americans will then eventually be infected with the virus, and we will have about 700,000 people die.
Yeah.
And at the peak of that, which will be later, probably towards the later part, later in this year, when that really gets rolling, if 700,000 people in the United States die, most of us will know somebody who died of the coronavirus.
Yeah.
That is when the maximum fear will hit us, and it will take us a while to get over it. We haven't, if Moody's is correct, and they are, unfortunately, in this case, very correct in their past analysis of what's likely to come, we haven't begun to see the effect of this. We're beginning to see it now. For those of you who don't already know this, in Houston, the ICUs are full. Yeah. They're going into overflow. They're going in. They're opening up stadiums and conference and convention centers to put hospital beds in for the people who aren't in ICU, and they're putting ICU beds in sections of the hospital that were never designed to be ICU supported.
They're beginning and those preparations in Austin and Round Rock as well.
And the problem with that, and you can say, well, we can always put up tents and put air conditioners in the tents and put the ICUs in the tents, except for the fact you can't just instantly produce a bunch of ICU nurses and ICU doctors.
Yeah.
And they're getting exhausted, and a lot of them are getting COVID. And this is a serious problem. That's the purpose in reduce. We forget this. The purpose in reducing the speed of this until we get a vaccine is to keep the medical system from being overwhelmed. It is already overwhelmed in Houston. It is already overwhelmed in San Antonio. And it's getting close to overwhelmed in Austin. And we've got ICUs in Central Texas in some of the hospitals already full, and they're turning people away and sending them to other hospitals. And the other hospitals are filling up. This is a serious problem that shows no evidence of getting a lot less serious.
Yeah, so the difference in the fears from today versus the Great Recession, the vast majority of the fears in the Great Recession were over the what was in an investment. If it was a collateralized debt obligation, collateralized loan obligation, collateralized mortgage obligation, doesn't really what you call it, were the ratings on that correct? How much money am I going to get back? Are they going to stop paying on it? Those were the fears, and very valid fears, because some of those packages were set up in a very, very sloppy manner that is only looking sloppy with hindsight being 2020, But it's scary because people didn't know what they owned. Today, people have a pretty good idea what they own. They're a lot more worried about where their paycheck is going to come from in 3 months. Most people are pretty okay with this month. It's the three-month point that they're looking up and going, I don't know what's going to happen there. I might not get a paycheck. That's a very different kind of fear. The bigger fear even than that is that I might get sick and die. So you lay those fears together against the Great Recession, and there's really not a big comparison. People are a lot more afraid today and angry today. If you remember during the Great Recession, we had the 99% movement and the Occupy Wall Street and all that good stuff. That was based on fear of financial stuff and that the really wealthy people...
The following is made possible by Dad.
Why was the basketball court all wet?
Okay. I
suppose that the computer decided that we needed to play those commercials before the end of the hour, even though I don't know what the commercials are. Are you still there?
I'm still there. Are we on the air?
We are on the air.
That's good. Hard to tell at this point.
Yeah, I have a lot of trouble figuring out where we are at any given moment as well. We've got just a couple of minutes left in this hour, and for some reason the commercials are set to play automatically, probably because we had, I'm guessing, 2 minutes of commercials in the hour, but there's no way of knowing that. Yeah, this is another symptom of COVID. I mean, the reality here is we've been doing this radio program. I've been doing it since 1998. I think you started at the end of 96 and did all of 97 on your own. And during that time, when we first started the program, we'd show up and there were lots and lots of people in the studio. And we had three producers with windows looking into the studio who were fielding calls and playing bumper music and doing all those things. Now it's mostly computers, and I don't want to wish ill on them, obviously, but I wouldn't be surprised if I showed up like next Saturday and the doors were locked and the lights were all off. So fears are different, and we're about out of time. Let me wrap up real quick and say if you'd like to contact us off the air, the phone number is 254-947-1111. You can go toll-free to 1-800-914-PLAN. Or email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. Until next hour.